coming up next on RCR. Speak Free with Simon O'Connor. In a topsy-turvy world, good old-fashioned ideas may seem foreign to some, but still make a lot of sense to many. Join Simon as he speaks with local and international guests to explore the values and perspectives that shape our world. Get your common sense fixed with conversations that celebrate democracy, freedom, and our fundamental rights. It's Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
It's Friday morning, 10 a.m. We're back. Where do the weeks go so fast? It only seems like yesterday I was on. The week prior, we had obviously Dr. Sean Palmer on talking about the monarchy. Boy, did that generate a lot of comments. So I've got a little bit of a lot of feedback in the mailbag to share with you today. Obviously, we had Tanya Unkovic as well. Lots of great feedback there as too around my friend Bruce. But of course, this is a new Friday. A whole lot has already happened. And boy, I think a great show ahead for you today. My key guest is Marianne Spurdle. She's going to be talking about the curriculum that our students and teachers use in our schools. Marianne's from the Maxim Institute. You might remember a few weeks back, I had her colleague, Dr. Stephanie Warboys, on talking about trust in government. Well, Marianne, I bumped into her the other week and was really taken by the work she's doing about our curriculum. And I think you'll be surprised how thin or how simple our curriculum is and the enormous amount of work that teachers are required to do. So we're going to have Marianne on. I've got my mate Bruce back from the United States. He updates me on news happening there. You'll be aware, of course, in recent days, Hunter Biden has been found guilty. So Bruce talks a bit about that and some impressions on the congressional hearings with or against Dr. Fauci, however we want to describe that. I've also got a new political commentator guest on, or new for the show, Liam Hare. He's actually a well-respected political commentator. He also, like me, writes his own Substack. Mine's called On Point. His is called Blue Review. So I've got Liam coming on. And with a spot of luck, I'll also have some time for Rachel. So look, a big show ahead. So glad to have you join me here on Speak Free. And as always, if you've got any thoughts as the show progresses, let me know at inbox@realitycheck.radio or text 2057.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
I've actually had quite a lot on my mind the last week since we were last on the show chatting. Actually, a lot of the feedback around the whole constitutional monarchy discussion got me thinking. As I say, we'll touch on that in mailbag in particular. But, you know, some of that deep hurt and resentment that the decisions that were being made at that time have impacted on people. And, you know, people, many of the listeners actually wanting others to stand up and speak for them. So it's actually had quite a profound effect, not just the discussion with Dr. Palmer, but the responses. So that's been on my mind. As to health in general, I've actually spent a lot of time, not myself, I have a family member in hospital at the moment. And so I've been spending a lot of time in hospitals most days. And I suppose what's been striking to me is, to be honest with you guys, just how bad the system is, how broken things are. The nurses, the doctors, the care staff, incredible. I have to say they are going the extra mile. That's my impression. That's my impression. But amazing job that they are doing. But boy, they are stretched. They are stretched. That real tiredness, I mean, obviously talking to some of them has an impact, you know, sort of firsthand conversations. I can't help myself. I can't help myself to go and talk to people. But it's really clear to me that our health system is in pretty bad shape. I mean, there are highlights. I mean, some of the, if you will, service has been incredible. But I was struck with some pharmaceuticals we needed. They weren't available via the hospital. We had to bring them in ourselves. And that reminded me of when I lived and worked in Fiji, that you basically had to supply most of your own materials. I thought, God, this is happening in in New Zealand. And then that made me think again, we touched on it briefly the other day around the budget, you know, because I've been in the oncology ward actually most of the time. So that might begin to give you a hint of what's happening to a family member of mine. But, you know, the government not prioritizing money for new cancer drugs, I still don't understand the logic or the oversight. I think, you know, maybe it was an oversight, maybe it's deliberate, I don't know. But, you know, it's possibly my former life and training coming in, I end up spending quite a few times talking to some of the patients and certainly their families in the ward. I mean, just harrowing stories when you think of some of the god-awful cancers that people are going through and then the suffering that causes to their family. But I was struck too, not only the drugs for some of them. Look, I'm no doctor, but I know enough of the various immunotherapies, which if they could get hold of them would make a difference in these people's lives. But all the challenges aside, I was also struck at how that time of suffering, if you will, was actually drawing families together and really important conversations occurring between everyone. So I suppose it's the paradox, without getting too theological on a Friday morning, but the paradox that, you know, these moments of struggle and suffering were also bringing, if you will, some positives for all involved. It's one of the striking things, and find it with my own family. I don't want loved ones suffering. None of us do. But, you know, it's remarkable how it's drawn us around the bedside and stories being shared, quite remarkable. So, yeah, as you can probably sense, quite a profound impact on me over the last few days. You know, within the political sphere, I continue to be worried, very worried about the increasing violent, aggressive language which people are using. I mean, the Maori Party are great exponents of this, but I look at some of the protest movements, be it around Gaza and what seems to be for some people a free license to be aggressive, violent, to deface and harass people. You would have seen a report from Thursday of Maureen Pugh, a National MP who was hit by a protest sign where she was at a public meeting. It's just getting a little bit out of control. And I say only a little bit out of control, not fully out of control, but we just seem to be sliding in a very, very poor direction, and it's just far too aggressive, far too violent. And when you have the likes, particularly of the Maori Party and the Greens to an extent, using quite extreme language at times, that doesn't help. And so, look, I'm grateful to you as listeners, as I am to the whole wider Reality Check network, that we have these discussions, that we actually can bring in guests on a whole variety of topics with a broad range of views to talk about things. You know, this is actually the way forward. So yeah, those are just some of the thoughts that have been on my mind this week. And as ever, very grateful to you all for your comments and feedback. And be it on this monologue or anything else, let me know what you think. Inbox at realitycheck.radio if you want to email, or text me at 2057.
We live in a world where politicians and the media and the dominant culture is to slice and dice us and divide us. What I love about RCR is it brings us together, joins us up, makes us feel part of something bigger than us, and builds this great human connection.
Within 2 weeks of my having a show on RCR, we had journalists from the legacy media begging the Prime Minister to cancel RCR. That's how used to suppressing the truth the legacy media have become. That's how quickly we can make a difference. They failed to cancel me, they failed to cancel RCR.
It's all about freedom in the end. Freedom of thought, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of travel, medical freedom, freedom to bring up your own family as you see fit, freedom to say the climate crisis is a scam, freedom to say that the transgender movement is sinister, freedom.
It's absolutely vital we keep this narrative going, because certainly the other side, the alarmist side, is really amping it up. I just find using climate and everything around climate, that was quite funny, really, wasn't it?
We are here to really transform the shape of what media is going forward, which is such an honor and such an exciting stage to be in.
You've got to have both sides of the story, and that's what we're here to do.
We want to have these conversations. We want to be able to talk about the stuff. We want to be able to say the things that you guys are saying to yourself in whispered conversations in case someone else might hear at the supermarket.
Here, what we get is a checking of reality. And checking out reality is the very essence of our mental health and our survival.
I'm delighted to have with me another speaker, actually, from the Maxim Institute. You'll recall I had Dr. Stephanie Warboys on a few weeks back, but I was very, very conscious of the work done by Marianne Spurtle around the space of education. And as listeners, again, a little bit of a hint from me, my wife is very efficacious or very effective in this area. She has followed Marianne's work, listened to the podcasts. I think you had an open mic night that was recorded as well, or was. And so Rachel's been talking to me about Marianne's work, and I got to bump into her last week. So Marianne, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Simon. Great to be here.
Yeah, well, as I say, my wife has spoken incredibly highly of your work. So I've gone and read your report, and so you've done a few other online commentaries on it. And it's around the nature of New Zealand's curriculum. But before I jump into that, listeners would probably want to know, who is Marianne Spurtle? What's your background, your interest and expertise into this area?
Well, my background is not in teaching, actually. I studied journalism. I worked in communications. I've done a lot of work in the nonprofit space. And along the way, I've been involved with Maxim Institute. I studied public policy at Auckland Uni a few years back. And then last year, I started full-time as a researcher here in the field of education. So it's been a learning curve for me. And I've got huge respect for people like your wife who are on the ground with the kids every day.
Yeah, well, she's there at the moment as I sit here enjoying the life of a radio host. Marianne, you've got a master's from Auckland University in public policy, I see. Yeah. And I noted from your profile, you've also got a Bachelor of Arts in Communications from the California State University at Fullerton. But where is Fullerton? I haven't jumped onto Google yet.
Fullerton is in Orange County, where I lived for about 15 years.
Well, fantastic.
The West Coast.
But now, I have sadly not been to Orange County, although I'm aware of it. There's so many TV shows which seem to come out of that area.
And Disneyland. The uni's close to Disneyland. But yeah, I was born in New Zealand and, of course, ended up back here because it doesn't compare to here.
Well, I think not dragging us into American politics, I'm actually chatting with my friend Bruce. He's on the other coast. He's on the East Coast in Maryland. We get all the political gossip, and this year's going to be pretty full on. But our focus, of course, is your recent research. So in September last year, you published Grading Our Curriculum, Failing Students, Teachers, and the Evidence Test. So quite an important piece of research, I would argue. But talk our listeners through... Yeah, what are you talking about? What did you find? What are some of your key insights?
Well, the curriculum itself was developed, released in 2007. It's been implemented since 2008. So it's a little bit dated now. And from early on, people were identifying problems with it. Just to summarize how it works, it is heavily focused on five key competencies, as they're called. And to give you an example, three of them are thinking, relating to others, and using language. And then learning areas, which we call subject areas, are kind of secondary to that. So the focus is very much on being able to do things. Knowledge takes a back seat. What you know is less important to, you know, this brand new knowledge economy that they were picturing in the early 2000s. Being able to do stuff, put things into practice. The problem with that is you can think, relate to others, and use language perfectly well without going to school. Like, those are things that we develop naturally as humans. So there's a lot of emphasis on things that actually aren't explicitly teachable. And the subject matter went from 60, 80, sometimes over 100 pages for a subject area for a year. The curriculum material for teachers has gone to a single A4, double-sided. So that gives you an idea of how much direction teachers have been getting. And this is since 2008. This is what teachers have had to work with from the Ministry of Education. Now, the advantage of that is that you can pretty much inject anything you like into the curriculum, and schools have a bit of autonomy that way. The downside is you don't have explicitly staged content material by subject, by year. And so if you've got a teacher who's not trained in curriculum design, which more than half aren't because they're teachers, they're not curriculum designers, there could be a deficit there. If you've got a teacher who doesn't know much about the subject area they're teaching, you're going to have a deficit there. So you've got this great variance in quality of education because it's so sparse. That's one of the problems.
Well, let's tease a bit of that out, because I think if I've understood you correctly, well, I think back, because I'm old enough to say this, when I was at school, not as a teacher or studying the curriculum, but we had textbooks, and it was very clear that teachers were drawing on a body or a corpus of knowledge that they were then imparting across. It was very structured, for want of a better word, and I probably have the nomenclature or the terms wrong, so correct me, but they had an extensive knowledge base that didn't have to be their own, is my sense, which they were then able to hand across. But you're saying in 2007, or rather we know in 2007, there was a substantial change. It became much more high level, to the extent that you've just said some areas have literally one page of what the curriculum is, so high level there isn't the detail in behind. Would that be a correct summation?
Yeah, there's plenty of cracks for important pieces to slip through.
Massively. So, I mean, from your research, did you get some insights of what the catalyst was? Why is it that there was a change?
Yeah.
Was it seen as that it was too structured, and this is the classic pendulum swung out to now, so laissez-faire, that anything goes?
Yeah, it was somewhat of a pendulum swing. And New Zealand, unsurprisingly, was behind other countries in rolling this out. So France in the 1990s introduced a curriculum that was similar to this in that it was very sparse in detail. They U-turned years ago. So that had been tried. And the philosophy was evident in the 1970s. Found this really interesting. There's an educational researcher from the UK named Michael F.D. Young. He's been quite influential. Going back to the 70s, he and some of his colleagues were looking into the reasons why working class students were so far behind other students. This is in the UK. And their theory, which to their credit they tested out before actually doing anything, was that the reason is there was this foreign curriculum that was being imposed on them, and that if they had a localized curriculum that was, they were more familiar with the contents, they would do better. Well, they were surprised to find that the localized curriculum designed specifically for them did nothing to improve their achievement. He classified it a well-intentioned mistake, assuming that this would improve things. And the conclusion he reached was that a more equitable education for these students was about not treating all knowledge equally, because the place of knowledge is a big part of the philosophy here. What is knowledge? He came to see that all knowledge isn't equal. It's making sure that all pupils had equal access to the same curriculum, and that curriculum needed to have embedded in it what he calls powerful knowledge. And I think of powerful knowledge as those light bulb moments that we all have in different areas where you get a puzzle piece that makes sense of a whole lot of other things. And if you're missing those key bits of knowledge, I mean, think back to, you know, the early days of school, learning addition and multiplication and how letters sound, like all of those things are useful across the board in everything else you learn, and you build on those things. Now, if you pull a few rungs out of the ladder because you don't think they're important, some students aren't going to make the leap to the next rung. So that philosophy was disproven by one of its original proponents in the 1970s, and yet, decades later, you still have education systems around the world. We aren't the only ones deciding that maybe we should focus on student-centered learning, see what students are interested in. And I actually have seen knowledge spoken of as, I'm quoting here, a process that develops to be replaced, not stored. And so you're teaching information based on what's relevant to the student, not what's relevant to the world that that student is entering.
Well, doesn't that in some ways To me, that reflects sort of the modern zeitgeist that is actually very self-focused. Yeah. And dare I go this far, sort of the narcissism, I would argue, that we see a lot of these days of what I think, feel, believe has to be affirmed by everyone.
Yeah.
And in an education space, by the way, I feel very free to disagree, but in an education space, the idea that the child's going to lead itself into the knowledge that it wants to seems a little bit too... well, too reflective of that modern mindset. I mean, fundamentally, how does a child or how is a child meant to know what it is or is not wanting to learn without having the tools? Or you talked about the rungs of the ladder set for them. So it seems all a bit around the wrong way, this child-centered learning, because that's been one of the big phrases of the last 20 or so years. It can't be 20 years. My math is terrible. I had a good teacher, but my math is terrible, so 15 or so years.
Yeah, it's been floating about at least that long,
But still prevalent now. I still hear it as I go, well, when a former life would go into the schools. Yeah, we want the child-centered learning. And if I might, one of it is, again, it seems a bit too self-indulgent to the person who needs to learn, the idea of being able to impart information. I would make the argument, by the way, says me to you, there's information around us all the time. In fact, in this modern world, particularly with the internet, we drown in information, but we don't necessarily have knowledge. I'd always make that distinction, which is why we want teachers to help, I would suggest, impart information and guide the process towards knowledge. But this must cause massive, massive headaches for the teachers. If you're like my wife, who's got, I think, 26, 27 students, or used to have up like 32, if 32 students are going off on their own individual child-led tangents, that's going to stress the teachers out terribly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the requirements for teachers on paper are impossible. They can't do what's asked of them. And the problem with having such a sparse curriculum is that it requires them to develop a lot of their own material or go find it. There is a really excellent report that Dr. Nina Hood put out last year based on a large survey of teachers in New Zealand. And that put numbers to it. She found that 76% of those who responded are responsible for their own instructional materials. And a teacher and academic friend of mine described that as reinventing the wheel by candlelight. They're just all doing the same thing over and over, instead of relying on, you know, expertise that can be shared around and then contextualizing it in the gaps so that you've got, you know, most of what is necessary, what is essential knowledge sorted. And then you can spend your time making things more individualized for students instead of spending all your time. Well, what she found was that I think it was about a quarter of them spend 6 or more hours a week developing materials. That's not necessary. You can have good teaching and good teachers without that extra workload, but that's what this curriculum has put teachers in that situation. Now, the other problem with that, as I mentioned before, is that not all teachers are going to come up with the same quality materials. So you've got people literally getting stuff off social media. It doesn't mean it isn't good just because it comes off social media, but that gives you an idea of the variation in what's being taught. And the other problem is it's not guaranteed that if a child switches schools, they'll be on the same page between schools or even between classrooms in the same school. So her report just highlights how this has led to way too much variation. And New Zealand has about the largest gap between high-performing and low-performing students in the English-speaking world. This probably isn't the only reason, but it's a big reason why it's not equitable.
A load of really important themes to draw out there. We might start almost chronologically. So you mentioned Dr. Nina Hood. So she heads up, is it the Education Hub? She's been a teacher herself. So for listeners to understand, a very respected researcher, academic in this space. And I think it's one of the, says me to you, Marianne, one of the key reasons why she's quoted. And that quota of work for teachers is phenomenal. So quite a few teachers in my wider family. And then living in New Zealand, we all know teachers. Yeah. They always are talking about the massive, massive workloads. And so starting on that curriculum side, it's because basically, I'm using your term again now, to reinvent the wheel. So they're given a page on maths or a page on English, high level, excuse my slightly derogatory, but fluffy concepts, and they've got to try and actualize it in reality and for each student. So, yeah, they are literally trying to create content each and every night for every school day. It's just, what did you say again? It was like 6 hours a week.
A quarter of them are spending six or more. I don't know what the average is, but the majority are spending four or more hours.
So you're talking about 15% of I was going to say 15% of a standard working week, but I'll put the rider out there really, really quickly to people that basically very few of us work fewer than 40 hours. So I'd better not perjure myself there. But that's a phenomenal amount of time they're doing to produce content because they're not meant to be on textbooks. But if I might, the paradox strikes me, having been around enough teachers now or having gone into classrooms, they're just downloading or accessing a lot of material from social media, from YouTube. I know there's a website, Twinkle, which is incredibly popular. So we've thrown textbooks as a country out the window. We say that everyone's just to go and create their own. But what we really know, I think, is most teachers are going to set sites, understandably, to try and draw content to create almost their own individual textbooks, which are just the same as everybody else's anyway, because they're all on the same website.
Mm. And you've got many of them saying that they don't think they've got access to high-quality material. The highest quality in the survey was the material that teachers produce themselves. They rank their own material higher than anything. Ministry of Education material was the second least popular next to social media as far as...
The second least popular, as far as
being seen as good material. So they're not well supported. The look into the curriculum gave me a bigger appreciation for what teachers are actually having to deal with, because the expectations have been raised that they will make education, more kind of custom to just specific needs. And there's a big focus on that, which would be fine if they were freed up to have the time to do that. But actually, they've got a greater burden than they had before 2007, when they had a more structured curriculum. And this isn't just, oh, it's harder. If you look at international research, there's a correlation between knowledge-rich curricula and both more equitable and better student outcomes. So it's not just that it doesn't sound like it won't work. There's evidence internationally in countries that have switched to more content-rich, they've done the U-turn, and their student results have improved.
Well, let's draw that out. I want to come back to the whole knowledge-rich element, because personally, and it's the philosopher in me, is worried about sort of this relativism in modern society, that there's no real truth, you know, quid est veritas, what is truth? So, you know, we couldn't possibly impart my view of the world or my view of science and maths onto a student. They must explore themselves. That sort of mindset, I think, is in operation. But let's come back to that. Mm. What you've touched on a few times here is the nature of New Zealand's rather light curriculum compared to the curricula. So good Latin declensions coming out here, by the way. In other countries that have gone for the knowledge rich, they're getting better results. So from your research and what you and Dr. Hood and others have seen, is basically New Zealand has slid in or has continued to slide in terms of its rankings across almost all areas, or is it only in particular spaces?
The OECD does every few years international surveys, like PISA is one of them. And all of those international rankings, New Zealand is either treading water or slipping behind. So we're not doing anything particularly well, according to international rankings.
And I have to say, it's been across many years. So in my time in Parliament, being on the blue team, then the red team were in control, and now the blue team are back. But the results are the same. I just wanted to stress that to listeners, that it's not a particularly, from my side at least, a political point. But
I was going to say, on the political side, it's interesting that people from all ends of the spectrum agree that the curriculum is not fit for purpose. And so it has been undergoing a review, which had kind of a start, and I think it's, I don't know, stopping at the moment while the current government figures out what they're going to do with it, because it's been undeniably unpopular. the question is it going to be more of the same? Are they going to repackage the same strategies and philosophies, or are they going to have a look at evidence and try to fit that evidence into a New Zealand context? And I don't know what's going to happen yet.
Yeah, I don't have a deep insight yet either. Unfortunately, I worry from my side, Marianne, of sort of an ideological capture, particularly within the ministry. Again, these are just my thoughts and observations that we'll want to hold on, because that's been evident to me for years now. As you say, we have lamented year after year about the sliding results of our young ones, and yet there's been no change. And so I do worry about it, but I mean, this is why your research is so vitally important. It's drawing out strong, clear evidence. It's just not working. And so, I mean, are there some countries then in comparison that we could look to? You mentioned France has done a U-turn, but are there other countries within, particularly the OECD, you go, right, we should look at them, that knowledge-rich content, enabling teachers to confidently source that information and then impart it in their own ways. Yeah, other countries we should look at?
I haven't personally looked into the content of other countries' curricula. Like I said, I'm not a teacher by trade, so that's another world to me. But I have heard New Zealand teachers, in fact, in Nina Hood's survey, some of them were saying they're looking at the Australian curriculum, because obviously it's similar to what ours is or should be, and they're finding far more content, far more direction in what Australia is using. The UK is in a U-turn. South Africa has done a U-turn. I've heard good things about education in Canada, but haven't looked deeply into what they're doing. So at this point, from what I've read, it seems like most countries, Estonia was one that Nina mentioned, that the curriculum changed and their student scores have improved. So pretty much anywhere you look, it seems to be heading in the right direction compared to where we are, unless indeed the curriculum review ends up with an actual change in course.
Well, I hope it does, because, I mean, again, year after year, we've seen poor results.
And we're seeing it. Teachers are leaving. It's hurting in every way possible, because you've got fewer teachers willing to take on that extra work.
Oh, when I used to visit the schools, I would visit every school in my electorate at least once a year and talk, obviously, to the principal, often to the staff. I doubt it will surprise you. It was the amount of stress they were under. And to put it rather crudely, it wasn't simply about money. Like, everyone wants to be paid more. Let's be clear about that.
Yeah.
But a number of teachers said, look, you know, we just want time. And you've touched on that a few times. They're like, we're just so time poor with everything we're expected to do. And as you, I think, critically touched on, the teacher here in New Zealand has been asked to create their own content for every topic. And there was some research granted in the primary school space more than secondary, but it noted a lot of our teachers coming out of training they themselves haven't passed NCEA level one maths or science. Half had failed English, and you're going, oh my God. And I'm not trying to throw stones at teachers. Any teachers listening, I'm not coming for you. It's just an observation of what's happening. But if they are not passing the likes of maths and science or have a very limited understanding, how is it possible that they could teach or create and teach?
Exactly. And we've got teachers in the classroom now who were taught by teachers under the current curriculum, if that makes sense. So we've got this downward spiral. If you're taught by somebody who doesn't like maths and didn't really get their heads around the first few rungs, what are the odds that you're actually going to be able to get your head around the stuff you need to progress? It's just hurting everything down the line.
Oh, to me, it's mind-boggling. I do worry at the level of excuses, or the array of excuses which are deployed into this space. It doesn't matter if it's from politicians or unions or otherwise. Again, it's a fundamental point. You can't teach what you don't understand.
No.
Or at the very least, I would argue you can't create resources to teach others if you yourself don't understand. It'd be like putting me in front of a Spanish class. It would be no good. We'll take a short break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, or even if you don't agree with what you're listening to, then get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057. Or if you'd rather email us, you can at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so get in touch with us now.
But I imagine, too, we're seeing much higher disparity. So we already know in New Zealand that there are disparities, particularly across socioeconomic groups, cultural groups. So if we're seeing a decline overall in New Zealand, would I be right in thinking the impact is even higher, say, on our Māori and Pacifica communities?
Yeah, well, that's what I was touching on with this gap between the high achieving and the low achieving, is the bottom percentages are doing far worse. It's not just that everybody's sliding a little bit. It's when you take out a few of the lower rungs of knowledge, those who aren't kind of absorbing it in whatever communities they're in, those gaps just get gappier, you know? It exacerbates itself, because if you don't have fundamental knowledge, then you're going to have a whole lot of trouble adding onto that, because you need foundations.
So it sort of brings me back to, because you've used the word knowledge, you've used foundations. Do we have trying to find the right words here, Mary-Ann, sort of a philosophical deficiency in this country, from your observations, that somehow doesn't believe there are foundations that we can agree on, or knowledge that we can agree on? Is there some sort of, deficiency there?
Yeah, when you were talking about, you said you're a bit skeptical of there being change. There are people who are, and it's like a religious fervor, their commitment to, you know, whether you call it student-centered learning or however you describe it, it sounds good. You know, the things that you're trying to achieve are all excellent things. And the argument against changing anything is that you don't want it to be overly prescribed. You don't want to be drilling kids in things that they're not interested in. They can't be bored. You know, there's this very black and white. It's either going to be student-centered, or it's going to be, you know, mind-numbingly boring. And they're just going to, we have got high truancy rates now with a student-centered approach. And in the words of Michael F. D. Young, pupils don't come to school to learn what they already know. You're going to have to, at some point, have directed instruction. And just because you do, just because you have a prescribed curriculum, doesn't mean that you can't focus on what students are interested in. A good teacher will get students excited about a subject within the framework of a good structure. So there's either or. They're very loath to let go of this curriculum. And I've met people, I've heard them talk about how proud they are of it, but I haven't heard them explain what needs to be done to help with the deficits. The deficits are clear, and they just continue clinging on to what they're proud of, which is good sounding ideals, really. It's not any evidence.
Oh, that's one of the things I found, not only in this space, but across many, that the great phrases, highfalutin statements, broad appeals, which all sound lovely, but when someone is pushed, there's little evidence to back it up. And often, if I might, there's calls for more money. Well, the solution is just more money, where I look at it and go, again, to teachers, you should be paid more. You well deserve it. Yeah. But I don't think it's going to make any difference when she said the poor teachers are running about every night trying to create new content. And I just sort of wanting to keep reinforcing that to our listeners, to understand that's what the New Zealand curriculum at the moment requires, is for teachers to basically take the high-end ideals or values of the curriculum and then to create their own content, which is incredibly stressful. And I imagine, too, it takes away from some of the energy that they would be able to deploy in the classroom.
Exactly.
Fundamentally, yeah.
Yeah. You can't spread them too thin and then expect everything to go marvelously.
What I'm finding, too, in some of the schools I've dealt with, they do a lot online now. So not only is the teacher looking at, say, the science curriculum, that says learn about, I'm not even sure, the universe. So they've got to go out and source all this material, but they've then got to translate it, if you will, from paper or whatever they source in, onto an online system. It's another level of bureaucracy. And I'm not arguing against the online learning, but it's just another step, another administrative requirement on top of everything else that they're doing.
Well, that's the kind of inevitable effect of being run by a ministry or bureaucracy. I mean, things only ever get more complicated, not less. So that's a whole nother conversation.
I could see that. Well, worryingly too, though, you mentioned earlier that the ministry's materials, excuse the alliteration, the materials of the ministry are the second least liked. People going elsewhere. So we've got a whole pile of people creating materials that no one wants to use. So, I mean, even that's a sick signal. Yeah. Just a couple of other points. Again, this child-centered learning, surely the evidence is overwhelming that, well, I'm going to quote King Lear because I love Lear. the play, that is, but the fool in Lear says nothing will come of nothing. And when I think of that in learning, if a child's meant to look to lead its own learning, if it doesn't know the basics, if it doesn't have the rungs, as you keep using analogously, how on earth is anything going to come of that? I mean, is there genuinely a pedagogy out there that believes every human being has all the knowledge deep within them from birth and they just has to coach it out? Is that the mindset in some of these educators?
It does seem to be so, and the idea that there are knowledges is out there, it's just incredibly relative. And we know, living in a physical world, that there are some facts. Things are true and not true. And finding out which are and which aren't is actually really important to navigating life well. So it's incredibly disconnected from our day-to-day experiences, but it persists.
I just find it mind-boggling. I think it's what I was touching on somewhat obliquely at the start. Is sort of there's this funny philosophy out there at the moment. You've used the term knowledges. I've often talked about people who think there's multiple truths rather than actually there's some observable realities, which is why drilling young people in their times tables is worth it. It's mind-numbingly boring. I hated it at school, but actually it was that knowledge base. I hope I'm using the right terms, but it was a knowledge base imparted, drilled, not literally, but beaten into me that enabled me to develop, whereas the current system seems, can't even seem to agree in some sectors. I was shocked to even understand that math has an element of truth. We're getting a whole lot now of discussion, well, there's like New Zealand math, there's Western math. It's like, what? That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
I'm pretty sure that mathematicians don't see it that way, people who've studied it as a science. And the funny thing is, there's this emphasis on critical thinking, on encouraging critical thinking. But if you don't have the facts straight, how on earth are you supposed to think critically about something? You will be thinking emotively, not critically.
Well, it's one of the things which drives me mad, amongst many, is the use of terminology. And you've just touched on one of them that our the ministry and others use a lot, which is students will be taught critical thinking. And when I first heard this years ago, and as I say, as a student of philosophy, I went, oh, that's fantastic. But it soon imparted that actually it's not critical thinking in the way most of us would ponder it or perceive it, rather. It's got a whole, there's no foundation.
No, there's it ends no up foundation. Teaching you what to think and not how to think, because to teach someone how to think, you have to give them a really great selection of knowledge to build on. And if you don't direct somebody's learning in a certain way and give them that information that, like you said, they're not born with. You know, we're not born knowing about the Russian Revolution or about mathematical theories. You know, all of those things have to be learned. And I think this ties in with how teachers are valued as well, because I kept hearing the phrase, teaching isn't valued enough. And so I went digging in that area, like, what would it mean to be valued and why are they not valued enough? And I think part of it comes back to what we see and what even some teachers see as the role of teachers. And if they're just there to guide someone along in what their, you know, their own private pathway, you know, just to kind of encourage them on their way, that is a completely different role to being somebody who can direct learning, who knows where the student needs to go to, you know, as Mike Lefty-Young speaks about that powerful knowledge. You want to lead them in the paths of those powerful pieces of knowledge that they need. That person is far more important than, well, the teaching council standards for teaching. I remember reading them and thinking that is pretty much what you'd want in a good babysitter. You know, a nice person who is encouraging and treats everyone equally and, you know, all lovely things, but there's really nothing in there about teaching. So, of course, you're not going to value a teacher well if they're not actually seen as teaching.
Well, Sam, look, this will be too much of a tangent with the time we've got left, but we're seeing work come out of the likes of Jonathan Haidt and others, which are actually talking teachers are more people there to manage emotions and the feelings of students and their well-being. In fact, that is a big problem in New Zealand, so much of the curriculum or focus now is on the well-being of the child. And it's like, well, actually, one element of well-being is learning.
Yeah.
But I like what you say. It is, and it's something I hadn't factored or considered, that, yes, as teachers as a whole are looking for more respect, well, rather, respect used to be based on having that knowledge, those skills to impart. But if you're on a more relativistic trend, which we seem to be in New Zealand, that really there is no truth, or you just make it up from your own experiences, then what is the role of a teacher? Why are you needed? And in fact, unfortunately, I've seen some, I'm not sure you'd call it research, but some, it's only anecdotal work, that often the high-performing schools, it really is because the students are coming in with great support through families already, and that the teacher's input is not as efficacious as it might be, which is unfortunate.
Well, and the interesting thing, looking at schools who work in like low socioeconomic areas where students aren't coming in with advantages, you know, their parents might not have been in higher education. There are schools that are succeeding in those areas and they are doing what we're talking about. They have expectations of students. They are good at managing behavior. They are helping them through the challenging things instead of removing anything challenging so they, you know, won't suffer anxiety and stuff like that. So it is possible in any community to have a school where students are succeeding. It comes back to what you see the role of a teacher as and what you expect your students should be doing as students.
Well, I did a record for another station a couple of months back with, of all things, my brother-in-law, who's also a teacher. The whole Bridges clan, from my wife to brother's mother, they're all these teachers and ex-teachers. But he was saying that in his school in recent years, they've encouraged, if not enforced, 20 minutes of reading at home a night. And he has seen education levels almost across the board increase. So you're going back to, I know it's a trite phrase, I apologize, but going back to basics, but that makes a difference.
And involving parents, making it normal to do stuff like that at home, because not all homes, that's normal. If that's introduced and it becomes normal, that can make a huge difference.
But that's exactly the tangential line that we went down as well, not just the educative benefits, but actually if you're sitting there with mom or dad or both, there's actually good relational elements too.
Yeah.
So obviously we've talked around the array of problems. We've even gone down the philosophical line, which I want to do, around sort of your relativism and everyone sort of self-absorbed, therefore how can anyone else teach me? But what are you seeing as what are some of the solutions moving forward? Obviously, a rewrite of a curriculum that's knowledge rich, but what would be some of the other encouragements you would have to the likes of the ministry or political leaders of today?
There are some noises in the right direction, I think, as far as revising the curriculum. It all depends on who is actually going to end up doing it and if they can actually accomplish what they want to. I don't know, you know, if I was Erica Stanford, I don't actually know what she needs to put in place to ensure that happens. That's a huge conversation. The curriculum does need to be more content rich. That will introduce some controversial elements because, you know, if you're talking about, say, history, not everyone's going to agree about what should be in there. So that isn't going to be without controversy itself. I think for most subjects, it should be fairly straightforward. For those areas where it's not, I think that is just more evidence that there needs to be better educational choice for parents. And that's a whole other topic, but in New Zealand, only about 4% of students go to independently operated schools. Most are in schools that are either state or state integrated. They have to use this curriculum. They're locked into the collective pay agreements. And that just means that when it comes to curricula, parents who, you know, it could be that the student has a certain area that they're interested in. They could be interested in a philosophy of teaching that they think is particularly good for their child. The options are really only available to people who have money, to be frank. If you can afford to live in a good zone, or a zone that has, you know, girls or boys school, if you can afford private tuition or private school tuition, then you've got some options. The vast majority of New Zealanders don't have options. And I think that is part of the problem, because there's going to be no national curriculum that makes everybody happy. That's just not going to happen.
Definitely a conversation, a much, much deeper conversation for another time. But if I could just, if we could just touch on it quickly, because yeah. I think New Zealand, and look, please factor in my political bias on this, because certainly in my time in Parliament, what I saw was a move for really to have one state system, anything to reduce the choice. Yeah. Now, again, that might reflect my politics, Marianne, but obviously removal of the likes of charter schools, no integrated schools, all of our faith schools under enormous yeah. pressures.
Yeah.
There was a desire to have just state education, and Chris Hipkins and others would often talk about being able, no, everyone be able to find a place where it was just, I can say it even as a step parent, anecdotally, that's just not the way it works. And
no.
Yeah.
Internationally, that's not the way it's working. The UK now, more than 50% of students go to independently operated, publicly funded schools.
In Say that again?
More than half of students are now at schools that are independently operated and publicly funded. Free schools and academies, which are 15 or so years old. In the States, charter schools have faced a lot of resistance, as they do here from teachers' unions. But there's still about 7% of students who are attending charter schools. They're all pretty much oversubscribed. You need lotteries to get in. So the supply isn't there, the demand is, but there are some alternatives. In Australia, state and national governments contribute to the tuition fees at both Catholic schools and independent schools, which means you've got a significant proportion of your students attending those, because far more families can afford it when they're not paying the full whack. So internationally, that's the direction it's going. OECD research, it was as far back as 2012, more than half of OECD countries were contributing more than half of private school funding. So we are an outlier. Only Mexico contributes less to independently operated schools than New Zealand. That's where we're at.
Gosh, I hadn't fully appreciated it. I mean, I'm very much for choice. I don't yeah. see a problem with a diversity. And
yeah.
I'm not just thinking of private schools or integrated schools as we think about them here, but, you know, even when I look at the, if you will, the special schools, Montessori and others, there's just such a need. And it, again, says me, the layman, noticing how many parents are making a choice to get their children out of state school. So either homeschooling now or searching out at the International Baccalaureate. But understandably, but I think sadly, that's only an option for people with money.
Yeah, or time, which equates to money. To homeschool.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
It's very, very few families can actually do that. And a lot would love to go to state integrated schools. I've got a friend who is the principal of one. They always have a wait list, and it's been growing.
And I suppose that's an example of where excellence shines out, and parents want that. And I found that across, used to argue with some people, think of the grumpy bums of people who would disparage those who are less fortunate than them and would, you know, blame poor educational outcomes on low socioeconomic groups. And I'd always argue back going, no, every parent by and large wants the best for their child. Every parent is looking for choices, but the way New Zealand's structured, you've got to go to the state school that you're right next to. And some are brilliant, many are, but some very much lacking.
The bottom 30% of high schools, I think only 2% get UE. I mean, what are your odds if you go to one of those schools?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's
not equitable at all.
No. And maybe I should wrap it up here. This is where the paradoxes I find come into this space so often, that actually what's being said or promoted is often not actually being reflected in reality. So people talk about New Zealand's world-class curriculum, but as we've discussed, it's not working.
Yeah.
You know, our skilled teachers, well, they are, but they're stretched often beyond capacity. And then you will often hear the discussion of choice. No, all these states will have all the choices within them. It's like, no, they don't. They don't at all.
Now, special education, that's a whole other topic. But special education students are extremely poorly served.
Oh, terribly so. We've got a number of friends of mine who have children, young people who need that support. And that is a whole nother discussion for another.
It's about more than just money,
It is. Well, this is always my soapbox because, look, if we could, I've said this in the parliament a few times, if all it took to solve the problems of education or in healthcare or crime was money, we'd have done it years ago.
Yeah.
That's the simple way out. Now, again, that's not to say people shouldn't be paid more, but that's another whole discussion as well. Marianne, I am so grateful for actually even more time than I had suggested to you originally
Thank you,
to
Simon.
Talk through. Yeah, can I encourage listeners, if they want to jump onto the Maxim Institute's website, so that's maxim.org.nz, and look up Marianne's work. And the report we've been particularly discussing today is entitled Grading Our Curriculum, Failing Students, Teachers, and the Evidence Test. So, Marianne, thank you so much for coming on and talking us through what I think is such a vitally important area, not only for our young people, but for our country.
Thank you so much, Simon.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, I have my old mate, Bruce, back from the United States. G'day, Bruce. How are you?
Hello, Simon, my old friend. Greetings to you Kiwis out there from Maryland. We have a gorgeous day. It's about 75 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, you guys use centigrade, and I have no idea what a gorgeous day in centigrade is, but it's low humidity, the sun is shining, blue skies, white clouds.
It's quintessential America by the sound of it. You're doing a sales job on us.
And you're moving into winter. So it is so weird to be on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, well, if you're at 75 Fahrenheit, that's about 23 Celsius. So that's a nice day in spring or summer here in New Zealand as well. Although we have in Auckland, where I'm based, lots of humidity. That's what does us. It's like maybe DC type weather, that humidity is what we don't like.
Oh, nobody likes it. It's oppressive and ugly. You just stand there and sweat.
Hey, well, before I get your take, obviously there's been breaking news in the last few days around Hunter Biden, but we got some great feedback last week on your coming on to the show. People were noting they've loved your voice. They're looking forward to hearing more about the states. But one person sent a question asking, what are primaries? Because this is something we don't have in New Zealand. We don't have, we talk about primaries. A Kiwi would think about primary school. But you were talking about primaries in politics. So you might just answer that. Well, can you answer that for listeners?
Sure, of course. Well, you in New Zealand, you guys have multiple parties. And so I don't know how your contest works, but as how we work is we've got two parties. We've got the Republicans and we've got the Democrats. And there's an occasional third party site. Yeah. But overall, it's Republicans and Democrats. And instead of at an election to vote for everybody, they narrow it down. They'll have like four or five people on one in the Democrats and four or five in the Republicans. Or sometimes it's a single person. Doesn't matter. And so they just it's the first step, I guess. And then the winner of that race then becomes the candidate of that party. Does that follow?
And then it does. It does.
And we are at the United States. So each state has its own way of electing its representatives, senators, whatever. Mostly the same, but there are variations on the theme. But overall, it's a whole bunch of people vying for one spot. And instead of the left and the right doing it on the big day, they do it individually. And then the winner of those, it's kind of like a playoff in a sports game. Like if you're in, the black shirts?
The All Blacks.
The All Blacks. So the All Blacks, they go into the playoffs. It's like the playoffs. And then you have your first round of the playoffs and then the second round. And then finally you go to the championship. Same thing.
That makes sense. And well, I hope that answers the listener's question. And we'll have to come back to the states element too.
Sure. The states element, well, today there were like three or four primaries going on. There's one in Arizona. I think there's one in Pennsylvania. And they are vying for members of the House of Representatives. They're looking for members if there's an empty seat in the Senate. They're looking at primaries for both. It's pro forma now that Biden and Trump are going to be the two candidates. But sometimes there's a third party or somebody else will come up. There are county councils, city councils, school boards. Each state, we're the United States, so each state runs its own Congress, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, well, it's like sort of 50 or so New Zealands. We're one little country, which means we have, if you will, one state. But yeah, you're a whole collection of them. But actually, speaking of the states, you mentioned Trump and Biden. As I say, the news is out now. Hunter Biden, he seems to be in big trouble.
He does. Hunter was up on gun charges, and it's a lot more serious than that goofy case that Trump had over a bookkeeping. This is a gun, and Hunter was, everybody knows about, he was addicted to crack cocaine. And so he decided one day he'd walk in and buy a gun. And on the form, it says, are you an addict, a drug addict? And he said, no, on a federal form. And that's a crime because he was. And he admitted it in so many words on this laptop from hell that has now resurfaced and is seriously in play. So Hunter's guilty. Now it's a question of what happens next. He's got another big trial, even a bigger one, in September on tax charges. And he didn't pay an awful lot of taxes. And that has teeth.
So what's this all? I mean, it's relatively new, of course, and we won't know how long for prison or not. But what impact is this going to have on his father, if anything, you think?
Nothing, probably not. Joe Biden, President Biden, has said that he will not. He has the power, but he will not pardon his son. To be determined. Right now, he's been convicted, so we'll have. He could be on his way out the door or something, because his poll numbers, President Biden's poll numbers, are the lowest in American history for any president running for office. He's down to 37.2, which is lower than what Jimmy Carter was. So,
well, go with that. that's serious.
It's only 37.2% of the people thinks he's the best candidate for the job. So we'll see.
Well, I have to say, I don't know much you guys follow the D-Day stuff. So quite a big thing, certainly over here. We follow it. I mean, Biden, he looked terrible. I have to. I'm sorry to say this about your president, but at the D-Day commemorations, he looked absolutely terrible. I mean, is this what Americans are picking up as well, or am I biased in some way?
It's embarrassing. It truly is embarrassing. When the 100-year-old veteran, this is a joke, but the 100-year-old veteran asks the president if he wants a seat. He's just doddering. He looks old. He is old. Obviously, losing his cognitive abilities for the hardest job on the planet. I think what they wanted to do was make him look like Reagan, with Reagan's marvelous speech in the early 80s, the Point Hawk speech, probably one of the best presidential speech ever. And Biden just bumbled it. And then his hobbling, just shuffling like somebody's great-grandfather over to do whatever he's going to do. And then there's some blowback back at Jill Biden. She flew back and forth twice. She went to Normandy, and then she went to Hunter's trial, and then got on a plane and flew back to Normandy again for the state dinner in Paris.
Oh gosh! But it sounds like she's not the only one in trouble. The British PM I see is in big trouble. Rishi Sunak, because he left the commemorations early.
Oh, yes, I heard about that. There's such green energy and everything is, low carbon and be this and save those. He's cut off everything. And then it looks very bad for Jill to take Air Force, whatever it is, two trips across the pond, as it were, where she could have just, got a charter jet or something. So I don't know.
And what's then happening for old Trump? Are they still, debriefing on his court case and his guilty verdict?
No, actually, it seems to have revitalized him. He has raised more money. He's raised almost $50 million just since the conviction came down. People are just, I think they've had enough. And no, he's revitalized. He's out. He was in San Francisco. He's going to the belly of the beast. The Democrats being a Republican, he was in the Bronx, which is, he lost by 90 points or something ridiculous in the Bronx for presidency. And then he was over in San Francisco last week or just a couple of days ago doing the same thing. So who knows?
We'll find out in a few months. I've been following a bit of Congress as well? They've been grilling Fauci as well around all the COVID stuff. Is that making much impact over there? Because they're really having a crack at him that he made up. It seems like he made up a whole lot of rules, which didn't have much backing. Mm-hmm. But is that something of new note?
Fauci. Dr. Fauci. He left the public eye January 1st. This is the first we've seen him at the congressional hearings last week. Nobody paid any attention. I mean, they were on. And yes, he did a lot of bad stuff. And it's pretty obvious yet dubious as to whether he did a bunch of cover-ups or was it the gain of function. It's generally understood now that gain of function happened in the lab. It was a lab leak. There was nothing going on in a wet market. But obfuscation in the government committees. As long as you got a committee, you can't blame anybody in particular. So, and their little code words and things. So I don't know if it'll ever come to anything. Fauci came and went. Right now, the big thing is in 2 weeks, we're going to have a presidential debate between Biden and Trump on June 27th. And that's going to be where the rubber hits the road, if you will.
It'll be massive.
Conviction and, is what?
It'll be massive, says me.
Yes. Yes, and CNN, who are partial to Biden, are moderating. So, you know, we've got about 2 weeks, and I think that might be the audition for Biden. Can he do it? Can he stand there and talk without notes in a debate setting for, what, 2 hours, I guess? You know, everybody knows Trump can do it. He won't stop talking.
No. Isn't Trump asking for a drug test?
He's asking. I don't know if we'll get it or not.
And so what else is, because we'll have to, I'll have to keep rolling and leave you to that lovely Maryland evening. But what, well, is there other news? What else is capturing Americans' attention?
A little bit of news. The blip on the radar screen right now is the new female basketball star, Caitlin Clark, member of the Women's National Basketball Association. We call it the WNBA. She is godlike, some would say, but she's not going to the Olympics on the American team, and a lot of people think she deserves it. The league says no, she hasn't paid her dues as much. I don't know what Brittany Griner is going to do. I don't think she's on the team. She's had enough of her politics with her Russian thing and drugging. What else is, you know, I've been curious. I've known you forever. And being a member of parliament, we call, with all these elections, our representatives we all have titles, Representative Collins, Representative, you know, whatever. What do they call you? Are you MP? Are you member of parliament? Are you, you're
people
honored,
call me
sir? You're what?
People call me all sorts of names. We don't have the. we don't. So there's no titles really. When you are a member of parliament, people will call you MP. If you become a minister, so you might think of those as the secretaries. When you become a minister, you take on the title honourable. But by and large, most members of parliament don't have titles. And importantly, as well, Bruce, we don't keep them. So in America, as you know better than I do, once you're a president, you'll always be, in this case, President Trump or President Biden.
We love titles. Americans love titles. You know,
yeah, well, we don't mind them. We've got our dames and sirs, but no, most MPs, we don't have a formal title, and we don't take any title with us. So you go in as Simon, you're known as an MP, and then you leave as Simon. And so that's the Kiwi way.
Oh, there was something about the Fauci that came up, was the 6 foot rule that the world grabbed hold of, you know, 6 foot during the quarantine and everything else, was totally made up. It's an arbitrary, there is absolutely zero science behind the 6 foot rule. I think that's the biggest thing that came out of those latest hearings.
Oh, I think it's just one other thing, actually, which is frustrating. I know people down here as well, that rules were just made up, forced on people, told it was the science. And as you pointed out, there was none. There was none.
No, it's never happened before. They were just making it up.
Bruce, I'm going to leave you that wonderful Maryland evening. I look forward to chatting with you again soon.
I'm having Maryland blue crabs tonight, which is the wonderful blue crabs, Maryland. That's what we're known for. I guess that's it.
We'll talk soon.
I'm just totally thrilled to be doing this, and you guys out in all you Kiwis out there, if you've got questions, anything at all, let me know, and we'll talk about it.
Good man. Thank you, Bruce.
Okay. Simon, good on you, man. Or good on you, mate, I guess.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand, with the government constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To revive honest media and support RCR, join our Foundation Membership Club today. To learn more, visit realitycheck.radio/members.
I'm delighted to have on board Liam Hare. He's a lawyer, a political commentator, and he's also one of the key authors of what's known as the Blue Review. It's a newsletter available on Substack. It touches on, as you might expect, politics and cultural issues of the day. So I really encourage you to check that out. But Liam, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I'm delighted. I think people get sick and tired of me giving my political views on things. So it's good to have not only someone else, but someone of your own, skills. You're a well-respected political commentator these days. And, you know, a lot of the focus, a lot of the political discussion at the moment seems to be around the accusations of the Maori Party. So I wondered, for the sake of listeners, could you explain a little bit of what's going on there? What's the scandal that's been accused?
Well, first of all, can I just say I'm certainly not sick of hearing your voice. I think it's great what you're doing in terms of post-elective politics for the time being. It's just fantastic that you're taking the knowledge and the skills that you've got from that world and bringing it to bear, to benefit the rest of us. So I'm appreciative of that.
Thank you. I've never been able to take compliments very well. I'm far too used to being attacked.
I cringe, and I grew up in one of those families where we were just always giving each other a hard time, and so any sort of compliments were always you're always checking them for danger. Yes. You know, where's the hidden thing in them, and not in a bad way, but just in the way that some families are. You know,
I can relate to that. Yeah, well, I've been used to being attacked.
Fortunately, I don't get too many compliments.
Oh right.
As far as Te Pāti Māori go, like it's fascinating to me. It's absolutely fascinating because that party has gone through so many versions of itself. It's like the Madonna in the pop star, not the religious sense of New Zealand politics, right? So it was formed as this protest party against the Foreshore and Seabed Act, and then improbably merged into what you would call a unashamedly establishment party, in terms of the fact, sort of the reason for it existing was to always be in and around the establishment and always have the proverbial seat at the table. And then
you'd be thinking those were the days of Tariana, Turia, and Peter Sharples in particular. Yeah.
At Flavel. But then sort of, you know, got wiped out, and it kind of like had a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, as they might have called it in the States, or a liquidation. And it sort of passed into new management, right? And it's sort of been passed into this new management where it's gone in this often this radical bomb-throwing direction. And one of the issues is that as it's evolved in this way, it's found itself constantly pushing on an open door. So there are things that if any other political party had members saying the types of things that the Māori Party says routinely, those people would be drummed out of politics and the party would be on the back foot. But for whatever reason, we just haven't had that kind of scrutiny applied to TPM, as it's now known, and the initialism is now quite common. Pushing an open door, you'd make a comment about how the New Zealand government was, hell-bent on exterminating Māori or something like that. And, you know, no real response. And by the way, just to remember, they made the accusation against Jacinda Ardern's government too. But no pushback, no scrutiny really from the media. There would be some belated reporting, but that reporting would always include a sort of a contextualization. And what happens? A weakness is a provocation, right? So the provoked to becoming to be more and more extreme because there's no consequence to it. And you see, therefore, I think a lack of discipline compared to other parties.
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. I mean, granted, as the former politician, if any of my colleagues, picky on the likes of National Act or New Zealand, actually Labour, any of them but the Maori Party had said the things that they have, or had I published a Facebook post with guns in it, I don't think I'd last 5 minutes.
No, I mean, you know, you would get in trouble for liking something on Facebook, you know, something, you know, which a solid block of the country was behind you on, and that was beyond the pale. And yet, yeah, it's really, really noticeable. What has happened since is that it seems like that kind of the kid gloves have also been applied by the public sector in New Zealand, right? And so, you know, we have had revelations from a whole lot of different sort of areas. We had Philip Crump, the from Twitter and NZ Plus, sort of plug. He's always been plugging away, trying to get documents and finding out the figures for things. And, you know, then you had Andrea Vance sort of drop the bombshell a couple of weeks ago about the serious allegations of data misuse, including, you know, the claim that data was misused by organizations within the orbit of Te Pāti Māori, and that people who were involved in it, in those organizations, blew the whistle on those organizations, with the public sector agencies doing nothing to follow up, really. And so it sort of feels like that same sort of spirit of indulgence has been extended. And it's always hard and fraught to try and attribute motivations to things. But I've always felt, in talking to journalists off the record sometimes too, that you know, there has been this hesitancy of calling out Te Pāti Māori because of the inevitable blowback that you're going to get, right? So you'll be accused of being racist, which is just such a toxic accusation to level against someone. And, you know, it has created a real fear. And within that sort of fear, you know, it looks like stuff has happened that shouldn't have happened, and stuff that could have been nipped in the bud a long time ago has been allowed to fester and grow and become a habit.
Oh, it's remarkable. I mean, look, I'm allowed to use the H word now, hypocrisy. I'm out of parliament. I mean, the hypocrisy's galling to me of what the Māori Party often call out of excesses that they perceive in government. And by the way, they're welcome to. They're welcome to call out what they want to. They're welcome to set up their own parliament. I think you actually wrote about that. That probably inspired some of my thinking that, you know, it's a free speech, they're welcome to. But, you know, when they talk about, well, as I say, these very extreme comments, but now what, and I have to stress this, it's only alleged at the moment, but what looked like pretty, I was going to say corrupt processes. I mean, in effect, for listeners to understand, and correct me, Liam, that long and short, that they've been accused, particularly through the Manurewa Marae, of accessing data that was being used during, is it COVID, been collected by Statistics New Zealand. They've taken, if you will, people's data being handed over to government.
Yeah. So there are a couple of ways that it's come about, right? So, in the first place, so you know, there's the census and there's the vaccination. So, as part of the vaccination drive, you know, and I appreciate that a lot of people who might be listening to you have some issues with the vaccination issue, but as part of the drive for that vaccination numbers to come up, the government of the day engaged with the Whānau Ora Commissioning Agency, which is one of these sort of affiliated organisations, you know, the sort of John Tamahere sitting in the middle of all of this. He's the related person to all of it. Information was provided to that organisation to help with the vaccination drive. Conditions were imposed in terms of data security, and yet somehow that information made its way, it's alleged, into the hands of Te Pāti Māori, who used it for campaigning purposes. Then there's the census, right? And so again, very much the same sort of idea. The idea being that the government needed to engage with civil society groups like the Marae to ensure that the census was completed as fully as possible. And so the census was involved in gathering information. The accusation is that the census information was photocopied and sent to Te Pāti Māori, and again used for campaigning purposes, and which is, you know, disgraceful. It's, you know, it's a misuse of state resources. It's a breach of privacy, and it's actually a pretty bad scandal if it turns out to be true. And I guess the thing is, now that we've got all these investigations going on, about 8 or 9 of them, we will find out, hopefully, if it is true or not.
Yeah, and I mean, as part of the context too, and correct me if I'm wrong, but who was then the chief executive or the leader of the Marae is now a Maori Party MP, right? Pukutai Tash Kemp. And she beat actually one of my old work colleagues, Penny Hanare. This is our work colleague. Penny and I worked in the Ministry of Social Development together years before Parliament. But she beat him by 42 votes. So I think, you know, again, for listeners to understand that if this is true, that the use of this, if it will, crown or state governmental data probably had a material impact on the, the outcome of an election.
So all of this comes in the, it's not isolated, right? And so in addition to the data breaches, there have been accusations over the, in the last while about, you know, inappropriate use of, you know, multi-party livery and things like that in promotional and public service communications by the marae, you know, all sort of at the moment of an allegation stage. And just to stress that nothing's been proved, and, you know, things are, allegations are often made that don't pan out. But it's just that there are so many different allegations from so many different angles. And sitting in the middle of it, you've got John Tamihere, of course, and, you know, everything's 1 or 2 degrees of separation from him and the Waipiriata Trust, which itself has a history of financial accusations being made against it going way back to the Clark government.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's another whole element within all of this, is just the sheer amount of money that's going through that trust. But do you think the Prime Minister said that there is an independent review now, but, you know, this is my opinion, but it's been done by the Public Service Commission. Is that actually independent in your mind? Or, you know, in my thinking, it should have been a retired judge or someone who was called in to be truly independent? Or am I overcooking, overthinking situation?
You and I are of one mind on that. You don't, I mean, all these different agencies have been doing their own, who commenced their own investigations, which they, you know, should have done a long time ago. But, you know, when the thing gets a certain momentum in the news, it becomes impossible to avoid. And so you have all these different investigations in which essentially they're marking their own homework, right? Like there's no, the incentive, of course, if you are investigating yourself, is to find that at the most, you know, mistakes were made. And there are opportunities for learnings. And so what the Prime Minister has announced is for the Public Service Commission to do an overall investigation into those public sector agencies. And it does kind of seem weird at first instance that you'd have that entity doing the review, because that entity doesn't have any, the Public Sector Commission doesn't have any oversight of political parties. But when you remember that the focus is on, have the individual government departments and agencies acting properly, it kind of makes sense. But I guess there still is the issue, right, of, you know, Wellington's a small place. It's, you know, incredibly incestuous, if I can use that word. There are personality conflicts and friendships and relationships, you know, across the whole city.
Yep, 100%.
And I agree with you that, you know, you want, ideally, instead of having the public sector looking into itself and reporting on itself, you'd be much better off getting someone who has unimpeachable credentials as a sort of a puritanical, you know, incorruptible, highly respected person who will make an authoritative sort of finding on all the issues, not just
It has to be beyond reproach. I wrote about it last week, granted, to do with the American situation and the court cases there with Trump and Biden, and how, it, in my view, it's all become, what do they call it, political lawfare. Yeah. And it's like, we just can't have any perception here because, you know, my sense is that the Māori Party will attack if there's any evidence implicating, and they'll make claims that this is a corrupt colonial government having a go at them. And so it has to be beyond reproach.
And so what's really interesting is the Māori Party have, of course, asked the police to investigate. I was on RNZ the other night with Bryce Edwards, and you know, Bryce said that one of his reservations about that, of course, is that, you know, you don't get to, for good reason, you don't get to choose who investigates you. And the New Zealand police have a long history, of course, of being quite averse to making robust decisions when it comes to political parties and political controversies. And deciding, you know, who to prosecute, who not to. They're just very conservative about that. And, of course, we can all remember the embarrassing situation where the Prime Minister of New Zealand was, according to the police, prima facie guilty of art forgery or something like that. But it wasn't in the public interest to take it further.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah. Signing a painting that she didn't do. And then, you know, of course, someone purchased it thinking that Helen Clark had painted that. And the police said, yeah, there's a prima facie case to answer for here, but look, it's not in the public interest. And, you know, I think the what Bryce was getting at, and I think there might be something to it, is that it's, you know, the police have a real reluctance, you know, and not without reason, to get involved in political controversies. So I am with you 100%. I think the situation calls for someone who is beyond reproach, someone who's unimpeachable authority and character, to make an overall report into the whole situation, not just elements of it that are convenient.
Well, I'm pleased I'm not the only one thinking that. I thought at one moment I might be going a bit crazy or had missed something. Hey, Liam, no. I'm incredibly grateful for your talk. We're going to have to get you back on if you're available, but I'm going to have to move on. But I'm just, again, grateful for your insight and explaining what's happening.
Anytime, I'd love to come back, so just let me know.
Fantastic. Everyone, that was Liam Hare, as I say, lawyer, political commentator, and if you haven't checked out his Substack Blue Review, I'd encourage you to do so.
Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, Fridays at 10 a.m, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
It's my favourite part of the show again, reading your thoughts and comments as part of the mailbag. So first and foremost, thank you to everyone who has text, emailed and messaged across social media. I'm loving it. So look, please always get in touch. You can do so via inbox at realitycheck.radio. You can text to 2057. Or, of course, you can jump online to, like, Reality Check's Facebook page, or obviously my own social media pages, and comment there. As I say, I love reading things. There's quite a few comments. I'm not going to get through them all. I'll start, though, with those around the interview with Tanya Unkovich. Beth, I think, sums it up beautifully when she says, Tanya Unkovich is a darling, a breath of fresh air in the political landscape. We're so blessed to have her as part of the coalition, and I never tire of hearing about her journey into politics and what she hopes to achieve. I'd even go as far as to tip her for the role of party leader when Winnie finally decides to hang up his hat. Thank you for bringing her onto your show for a chat. And that was from Beth. And Robin echoes that by saying, Tanya was an awesome guest, as does Miko. Tanya was an amazing, was as amazing as I expected. And Miko goes on with some stuff around the monarchy, but I'll come back to that. So obviously lots of lovely feedback about Tanya, also including Claire Louise, who was saying it was so nice to hear her speaking about her life. She seems very empathetic. So she was great, and we'll have to have her back on. Also got some lovely feedback about Bruce. Heidi says, as Simon promised, we'll be hearing more from Bruce in the future, and I love how quite a few of your guests are becoming regulars. Well, Heidi, that's certainly one of my intentions. I mean, each week I'm going to have new, if you will, and unique guests, but having Bruce's perspective from America, and obviously Rachel, when she can, to come on and have a chat with us. I just think it's a really nice part of it all. As expected, though, as I expected, the discussion about constitutional monarchy stirred up a lot of thought, both those in agreement and those who thought we're barking mad. And understandably, too, a number of people going, well, hold on a moment. Where was the monarchy? Where was the Queen? Where was the Governor General during the COVID times? And as Penny writes, where was the monarchy when we had lockdown? Where was the monarchy when people were undemocratically coerced into the vaccine? Others write similar things. I mentioned Miko earlier. After the COVID trauma, they write, that fellow claiming our constitutional monarchy was the best made my blood boil and I had to switch off. The last 4 years makes it painfully obvious we lack a robust constitution like the United States. So there are quite a few like that, and others, Keith, for example, wrote not just around COVID, but a whole lot of other, often in the ethical areas. So he's talking like abortion, euthanasia, marriage, is saying, look, you know, why would the Queen sign off on all of that? So strong, consistent feedback in that space. Look, I think the key is we ultimately are run by a parliament. We were discussing quite at length Dr. Palmer and I about when, if ever, does the monarchy step in. And, I think many of us don't like the way that, the Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern at the time ran the government, the decisions that were made around mandates. That's two classes of citizens that she talked about. But, the counter-argument of a sort in this space is she's part of a democratically elected government that passed the laws. They passed, and it's sort of almost beholden on the monarch to sign that off. And, you could point to the fact that she then won an overwhelming majority at the next election, that, again, that a democratic decision was made. I don't think the right decision. I don't think the right decisions, but it's still quite a bold move for any monarch to step in and override that. I mean, at the end of the day, that's where the policy arguments are. It's in the parliament. Monarchs, kings and queens and governors general are not the if you will, the backstop for us to or the last trump card to play, as uncomfortable as that is. But I will add, there were a number of conversations myself and a couple of MPs were having at the time going, as various human rights, like the ability to make our own medical choices, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of religion, were being undermined, to go, actually, have we crossed that line? And I suspect very strongly that actually those discussions would have been had at the palace. Other questions that came through, Merrin asks, I'm really curious to know where Crown revenue goes. They say, is income tax, does that go to the Crown? Well, the short answer is yes, but when we talk about the Crown in New Zealand, we effectively mean the government. We don't mean King Charles. So when we pay our income taxes or we pay concessions on dock land, that money's not going to Charles or Prince William or anything. The Crown means the government of New Zealand. So when we pay our taxes, we're paying taxes to the Crown of New Zealand, which is the government and the IRD and so forth. Others ask, wasn't New Zealand incorporated as a country in 1887 to become a city of London incorporated, similar to the East India Company? Short answer, no. No is the short answer. 1840, of course, the Treaty of Waitangi. I think 1901 we became a dominion and then fully independent in about 1947. Another person says, well, the New Zealand Governor General's not been appointed by the King or Queen, but by Parliament. The concept then of acts receiving royal assent's meaningless. Not quite true. The King now appoints a Governor General on advice from the government of the day, in fact, from the Prime Minister, in agreement with the Leader of the Opposition, but it is advice. It's accepted usually because, again, just like we were discussing earlier, that the parliament's been elected, they're democratically elected. They can be making, crazy decisions, but they're being democratically elected. Strictly, the king today could turn down that suggestion. In fact, for argument's sake, if you really want to delve into it, it's quite possible that the queen in the past or the king today has turned people down, but we'll never know. They don't publicise that. And at the end of the day, the king these days signing off a piece of law is still something that has to occur. It's not meaningless. As we discussed a little bit, they can stop that. They don't have to do it. They don't have to do it. So that's really important. Others have said, look, I was contemplating whether I'm a Republican or not, but after today, or rather last Friday's show, I believe I'm more knowledgeable about the usefulness of the king. Mary says, Dr. Palmer is excellent. The interviews altered my perspective on the royal family. Others, though, have said, you've forgotten the most single important thing. Monarchy is unethical. Others have noted as well how the monarchy, King Charles now, seems a great fan of the World Health Organization or the WEF and so on, or certainly the UN. He's very, very supportive of that. So that's important to say. I mean, Anne sums it up. It was interesting to hear some of the positives, but the main issue we have is that Charles, a massive proponent of the UN sustainable goals, the Build Back Better mantra. So the extent of that cost to New Zealand is immeasurable. But Pam, in contrast, says, I'm a fan of the royal family, and I really enjoyed the discussion of the role of the monarchy in New Zealand. The explanation of the role reaffirmed my own thoughts. So I thought that was really Again, a mixed series of thoughts, as you would expect, as you would expect. So, guys, keep the messages coming in. Always hit me up. You can via email at inbox@realitycheck.radio or text 2057.
Want an easier way to listen to RCR? Well, you can now download the brand new Reality Check Radio app, both on iOS and Android. We've completed our beta testing, and the app is now live. You can visit the app stores direct or find out all you need to know at www.realitycheck.radio/app. That's at realitycheck.radio/app. Our test bunnies have been hard at play to ensure you have access to everything, from listening to our live broadcast, downloading some of our incredible interviews, and checking out the latest blogs, all from the very same app. So get listening and download the RCR app now.
Well, I'm very happy to have the wonderful, beautiful Rachel. Obviously, we're on radio, but you have to take my word for it. The lovely, beautiful Rachel, my wife, is back on. She had to miss last week. It was all a bit crazy, wasn't it?
It was.
So she's back with us today, and so I'm delighted to have her on for a few moments to chat about what's happening. We've had quite a few people, first and foremost, asking where you were, but we've had a couple of questions coming in, actually. It's a bit of a personal nature, but they're asking, how did we meet? How was it you got to, well,
marry me?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you want the long story or the short story? So I'll try and make it not too long. It starts with my mother, actually, sending me a clipping of, apparently there was a new candidate for Tamaki. I live in the Tamaki electorate, and I'd been involved in the National Party.
Sorry, just jump in there. When she sent you the note about this new candidate, did she have any adjectives, you know, handsome,
no,
charming?
Yes, single.
Single.
Anyway, I'd been supporting the National Party locally, just delivering flyers and that, ran our candidate, Alan Peachey, but unfortunately he became very ill and passed away. So my mother had sent me this little clipping of the Simon O'Connor guy, and he was single, but that said, I wasn't really interested in that anyway. So I went to the candidate meeting in the St. Ignatius School Hall, and there he was in a crowded room. Again, I still didn't think very much, but there was an invitation to invite him to your home just to meet locals. I'd lived in the area for a couple of decades, and Simon was new to the area. So I thought, oh, may as well, you know, I want to get in and support him. So that's what happened. I invited him to my home, and the very short story is he never left. But that would be missing out a lot of details if I...
I remember that meeting actually up in St. Ignatius Hall very, very well, not just because of yourself, but for me personally, it was exceptionally, exceptionally busy time, but you did catch my attention. But I think it would be fair to say neither of us were particularly seeking relationships at the time.
Not at all. So came to my home, chatted away, met my family, met some of my friends. He was super busy campaigning. And then he just, I don't know, thanked me. I think we had email, thanked me and said, oh, we should catch up sometime. This is Simon said that this, catch up for a coffee sometime. I'd like to hear your viewpoints on, I can't remember what, something to do with politics. So I caught up for coffee. Then there was, oh, we need to catch up for lunch and find out about something else. And then he just happened to, I think, did you have the arts portfolio? Is that correct? Or something like that?
Actually, I can't remember. I don't think I had the portfolio because I was only a candidate at the time, but I was very interested.
Once I got elected,
yeah. I was certainly had an interest in the arts and was being chased, if you will, by various organisations around Auckland. So I got lots of tickets
free
and invites.
Tickets. So he just happened to have lots of free tickets for concerts and theatre and that sort of thing. And he just happened to need somebody to come along with him. And I just, by this stage, happened to always be available no matter what else I had going on in my life. Because by that time, do I declare I was smitten?
I was probably a bit slower myself, to be honest, insofar as A, intrigued by you, but also fascinated just by people. I loved conversations. And, you know, I was struck a little bit by you. You were now, well, you're basically a solo mum with five kids. So for me, like, hey, well, come on out. Let's, you know, enjoy various evenings and be at performances, Philharmonic, whatever. But it's just sort of funny how it all developed from there.
So, yeah, basically many, many, many months later, and I didn't even know where he was thinking, but he just kept asking me out. Then finally, you can say at the opera.
At the opera. That's right. Rigoletto, for those who are well-cultured and want to know, it was Rigoletto. It was quite the opera, actually, quite the opera. But, yeah, I eventually got there. We're going to have to stop it there because I know you've got to get back to your work, and I better carry on here as well. We might have to pick up the rest of the story another time. But, Rachel, thanks so much. Part two or part three and four, who knows? Yeah. Hey, thanks so much for joining me, love.
Bye.
Well, what a show. Where do those 2 hours go? I just don't know. But look, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I've thoroughly enjoyed all the chats. Look, it's one of the great privileges of this role, and I'm very grateful to you as the listeners and to the wider RCR team for being able to be part of this radio station, because I get to do something I thoroughly enjoy. And some of you are going, oh, you mean talking? Well, maybe that's part of it. But no, what I thoroughly enjoy is actually talking to people. I love hearing their ideas and thoughts. And I think we've had a real treat this morning. I'm really grateful to Marianne Spurdle, for talking us through her research around the New Zealand curriculum. I think worrying just how much work teachers are expected to undertake because of such a light curriculum. And so I'd love to hear your feedback on that. If you've had, you know, your own teaching experience, many of you will be teachers. Obviously, many of you will have kids at school. Tell me what you think. Do you think her research is right? I thought it was good to hear from Bruce. He just makes me laugh. He's just such a... hard to explain via radio, but he's just one of the most jolly, happy people you'll ever meet. And his wife, Nancy, they're just such a gorgeous, wonderful, wonderful couple. Delighted to have Liam on as well. Liam here. He is a well-respected political commentator. He's very insightful, but also very, very articulate. I think part of it's his legal training, but I've known Liam for years, and just the way he can articulate things is deeply appreciated. And Rachel, of course, I was pleased that she was able to take my call today and have a little bit of a chat. She remains always, of course, the love of my life. But there we go. The show is done for another week. Drop me a line at inbox@realitycheck.radio or text me at 2057. Otherwise, you have a great day.
Celebrating Western values, our democracy, and our rights, and hearing perspectives from right here in New Zealand and overseas. We live in a big, well-connected world. So join Simon O'Connor as he talks to guests from home and abroad about the issues that really matter. Join us at 10 a.m. every Friday, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.